It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we channel our Northwood spirit and find out about the Lumberjack World Champions.
First, we're talking about the debate over flying the Confederate flag in South Carolina. Earlier this afternoon, Republican Governor Nikki Haley called for taking the Confederate flag off state capitol grounds.
And we also heard a tweet from Scott Walker saying that he is glad that she is calling for the Confederate flag to come down and that he supports her decision. This weekend, imagery popped up of confessed killer Dylan Roof embracing the Confederate flag. Roof is a suspect in the shooting that killed 9 African-Americans in a Charleston church last week. The debate over the Confederate flag has become an even bigger issue because South Carolina is the first presidential primary in the South.
Here to talk about how this debate is unfolding is Katie Glick. She's a political reporter for Politico. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how did the conversation move from the racially motivated shooting at the church in Charleston, still a big part of that picture, but how did it center so much now on the Confederate flag?
Well, certainly the initial focus, of course, was on the event itself, and there was a lot of pressure on some of the presidential candidates to spell out sort of whether they thought it was racially motivated. But as the week wore on and sort of as Roof's views on that flag, and more broadly, sort of became apparent, that became the issue of the day.
Now, this isn't a new debate in South Carolina. How long has this debate been going on?
Right. Well, it's long been a controversial issue, and that's something that we've seen play out in other southern states as well, going back decades. And it kind of continues to be a hot-button issue in many places in the South.
I know there's been some polling done on this, but do you have a sense of whether the needle has moved for anybody thanks to this shooting, this church shooting in Charleston?
Well, it's a great question, and we'll probably see how that plays out as the South Carolina state legislature, actually prepares to take this on in a debate. But, what is telling is that, you see the governor coming out, you see bipartisan leadership in South Carolina and nationally coming out and making a pretty forceful case for removing that flag. And so, that is certainly a shift to see the leadership, both sides of the aisle in the state of South Carolina, coming out and making that case.
Right. It seems as though that perspective has been fairly vocal, the people who think it's appropriate to take down the flag. What are people who think that it's more of a heritage issue and they'd like to see it stay where it is? What sorts of avenues are those people taking to express their thoughts?
Well, there's going to be time, of course, for those perspectives to be heard as this debate is taken up in South Carolina. And that's something that Governor Haley tried to acknowledge as well. She noted that, for a lot of people in the state, it is a symbol of heritage. It's a symbol that honors ancestors. It, for some people in the state, it's an important symbol for them. And, she, in her statement just a couple minutes ago, tried to be respectful of that heritage, but at the same time said that it's really time for the state to move on. And this is an issue that other states, including Florida, have confronted as well, but particularly potent in South Carolina this week.
We're talking right now with Katie Glick, a political reporter for Politico, talking about the debate over the Confederate flag in South Carolina, including Governor Nikki Haley and now Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin saying, take down the flag. This is the right time. And Katie, what would it take legally for the South Carolina legislature to remove the flag from the state capitol?
Well, it looks like, you may, there has been previous legislation that's called for a supermajority, in the legislature, but Governor Haley made clear that she is going to put kind of her whole I guess the weight of the governor's office, behind this. But before she had come out, others, especially in the Republican presidential field, but other, senators of, those from South Carolina as well, were really sort of holding off to wait and see what she was going to do on this issue. So clearly her voice and her position on this are highly influential, and she made clear that the legislature better take this up, and if they don't, she's going to call for a special session to make sure it gets addressed.
Is there a sense right now that this has a lot of momentum behind it?
Well, I think it will be interesting to see just how vocal the people who do want to keep that flag in that position, just how vocal they are. But, at least politically, there certainly is momentum in South Carolina and nationally as well. Now, whether that does reflect all the voices in South Carolina and those that are going to be, particularly vocal on this, I think remains to be seen, and we will see that play out in short order. But at least politically, I think you can say the momentum is with Haley. And, one really good example of that is a number of presidential candidates, including, of course, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who had been kind of keeping their powder dry on this issue, had not wanted to get out ahead of Governor Haley. Now they've come out and sort of lauded her for the move that she just made and said that she made the right call. So, on the Republican side as well, on the presidential level, that does seem to be gaining some traction.
Well, as we mentioned, the debate has gotten even more political traction because South Carolina is the first presidential primary in the South. How is this issue playing out among presidential candidates so far?
Right. So again, a lot of people over the weekend, we certainly asked them about it, but a lot of them did not want to comment or at least didn't want to go in depth on their views on this and kind of tried to walk a fine line. Some are saying now that they wanted to be deferential to Governor Haley, wanted to sort of let her take the lead on this Those presidential candidates who are not from South Carolina have said that they wanted to leave it to the state. But as soon as she kind of gave the green light with her announcement, you saw kind of a flood of presidential contenders: Ohio Governor John Kasich, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and of course Governor Walker from Wisconsin, among those who are coming out in support of what Governor Haley has advocated for.
It seems as though this issue could be a sticky one for Republicans because the party is trying to attract more minorities while still appealing to white conservatives. What are Republican candidates saying about that, about wanting to appeal to both sets maybe of voters?
Well, the issue is one that in some ways may be unique to South Carolina, which, of course, it plays a critical role in the Republican nominating contest. It's going to be the third voting opportunity in the Republican presidential primary. So on that level, there are maybe some sensitivities there, and a lot of the presidential candidates were looking to take their cue from Governor Haley. They didn't want to be seen as sort of dictating to a different state. So you have seen some walking of fine lines, but at the same time, given how quickly some of the candidates were to sort of back her up, that may be telling as well.
Any word from Lindsey Graham of South Carolina Republican senator and 2016 presidential candidate?
Yeah, he was there with Governor Haley. He supported that move as well. It looks like, as we speak, Texas Governor Rick Perry, former Governor Rick Perry, who spent a lot of time in South Carolina as well, is running for president again. Looks like he's coming out and supporting this as an act of healing and unity. So it'll be interesting to sort of see how these candidates are reacting as the news kind of continues to trickle out. But you do have Senator Graham from South Carolina supporting this as well.
Now, this isn't just a South Carolina issue. Obviously, this is the epicenter of this issue right now, but there are other states that have tributes to the Confederate flag in their own flags that they fly. So do you see South Carolina right now as being maybe at the vanguard of a movement which could represent a tipping point toward the way this flag is viewed and allowed to fly in the United States?
Well, that will certainly be interesting to see if that does set off, movements in places like Mississippi, for example, where there's also that similar dynamic. I think you have the political spotlight on South Carolina, both because of the events of last week, and then also, the reason you're seeing presidential contenders getting grilled on this in the way that they have been is just because of the role that South Carolina plays in the nominating contest. It's something to keep an eye on in terms of whether this does set off chain reactions in other states as well.
Now, the South Carolina primary is proposed for February, which is quite a ways off, 8 months away. So do you think that this issue is still going to be on the radar and is still going to matter as deeply to people in February as it seems to matter right now?
Certainly remains to be seen, and we got to see how this works out with the legislature and sort of where tensions are or aren't in February of next year. You certainly saw some hesitation on the parts of presidential candidates to not get ahead of the South Carolina leadership in weighing in on this. And Governor Haley kind of gave them the green light and perhaps offers them a little bit of cover and movement on that issue unless, there is a huge backlash. But at least politically, there does appear to be bipartisan support for this in South Carolina and nationally. So kind of remains to be seen how big a deal this is going to be in that primary.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
That was Katie Glick, political reporter for Politico. She was with us to talk about the debate over the Confederate flag in South Carolina and how that's unfolding so far.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. You may not realize it when you see Ken Shells wielding his chainsaw at carving competitions, but he thinks deeply about trees. Emily Bright got a tour of Shells' workshop and a glimpse into his mind as he sets about his carving.
When I grab my saw, I'm ready to carve. I'm hungry. I want to make some sawdust, and I'm looking forward to it.
Ken Shells may not look like a poet when he's hauling trees to a sawmill or wielding his chainsaw at carving competitions, but he thinks deeply about trees. Dressed in plaid flannel and a cap, Ken shows me an 11-foot conference table which he cut from a local century-old tree. He points out small dark marks on the tabletop.
So there was metal in every cut. Somebody hung a sign. There was a party. They hung a balloon in it.
Nails in a tree, permanent marks in the wood. Trees will tell you a story. That's what Ken, like his late father Carl Shells, loves the most.
My folks were married in 1939 here with $10 in their pocket. They went out to the Nicolet National Forest, squatted on government land, and lived there for 8 years without water or electricity. My dad was an outlaw beaver trapper. So they've been pioneers, and I am very proud of where we come from because I think it makes you who you are.
His family was living back in town by the time Ken was born, but their living always came from nature. Ken started carving to make gifts for his father, and it soon became a business.
I would probably describe myself as a craftsman. How about a craftsman with a big imagination?
Sometimes that imagination leads to metal art as well as woodwork. Like a dragon, welded from washers that actually breathes fire over the shop door. Inside the tall open workshop, several projects are going, like a whimsical hobbit house as big as a one-room cabin. Ken's nephew, Robert Shells, is welding old farm implements to make the face of a 3-foot metal frog.
How many washers in the frog, Rob?
About 815.
About 815 washers are welded together. And its sigh, that's going to be his tongue like that. This sigh will even tell you a story if you pay attention to it. It's very wore down.
The creativity around the shop is supported by a great deal of work and planning. 2 semi-loads of wood take up a good third of the space, drying for at least 4 years before Ken works with them.
That wood has a lot of power. You're asking the cells to change very quickly if you open the grain up, so you want it to move slowly if you can.
Ken admits planning new projects will keep him up at night so that he and his 2 employees don't waste a minute during the day. At age 60, he has no plans to stop, but he admits the work is physically challenging.
A lot of stuff is, hundreds and thousands of pounds. We don't hardly do anything small, so I can tell the difference, than when I was, 10 years younger.
There's always something waiting to be built, another tree ready to tell a story if only you look close enough. Because if there's one thing Ken has learned, it's that the true craftsman is nature. He gestures to an end table whose hollow, gnarled base he'd saved for 25 years looking for the right project.
I mean, that is a good example of nature's work there. I mean, you can see all the wrinkles in it and you know, all of the design. It's just, it's a beautiful piece of wood.
All the carver does, Ken says, is remove the parts he doesn't want so you can see the rest.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Well, every summer, lumberjacks and lumberjills from all over the world flock to Hayward, Wisconsin to compete in the Lumberjack World Championships.
Joining us now to tell us about the history of the competition is Lou Friedman. He's the author of Timber, the Story of the Lumberjack World Championships. Lou, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us. Having me here live from, we used to live in Central Time not too long ago, but I'm in Rocky Mountain Time right now, where I think we have just as many trees but fewer chainsaws.
Ah.
Well, can you tell us a story about the beginning of the competition?
Well, my story in it is that I watched it for years on television and always dreamed of having the opportunity to go to Hayward, Wisconsin and attend the Lumberjack World Championships. And in the early 2000s, I became the outdoor writer for the Chicago Tribune and convinced them that that was an event they had to go to. And I loved it. It was a blast. The people were always great. I love the vernacular sometimes where the sawers talk about just making sawdust, you know, that just... They like to see that those chips fly, and it's they do wear ear protection. It's sort of like being in a shooting sport, I guess, in terms of what it does to your ears. But I've met some great people early on. There's some people who get it in their blood and always come back.
What did you see that first year? Did you come away seeing some amazing things that stuck with you?
Amazing things is true. I mean, and the story behind the origin of the games is pretty. Involves a visionary in Tony Weiss, who began things in 1960 and really thought it could be a special event and dreamed of it being a worldwide phenomenon. But the one athlete who made the biggest impression on me early on was a fellow named Jason Wynyard, who has just been a dominant athlete for more than a decade in all of the events that involve strength. But I've been a sports writer for most of my adult life, but the most inspirational athlete I think I've ever covered in any sport is from the Lumberjack World Championships.
Now, when this started, were the people in it real lumberjacks, or were they athletes who liked to do lumberjack kind of stuff?
I think there was a little of both, and they got into the overlap. You know, they started, there were more professionals who were in jobs, made their living in that world, and they became more focused as athletes.
Hmm.
And what events are we talking about?
The heavyweights do the power sawing things, you know, the sawing competitions, the lighter weight people do log rolling, and the way they can balance on logs as they're spinning is breathtaking to watch to keep themselves from falling into the water. Then there's the people who climb poles who, you know, emulate what it was like to climb trees and trim them at the top.
Now the sawing thing, is that where they have one of those big honking saws and one person's on one side and the other person's on the other side?
Yeah, and they have just the aptly named mixed doubles there with Jack and Jill sawing.
Oh, really?
One man, one woman.
And has that been happening the whole time, or was that something that started more recently?
I'm not sure it was from the very beginning, but a few events have been added over time, and all of the ones that are contested now have been around for a long time.
Now, it sounds like at some point this event landed on ABC's Wide World of Sports. Did that change thing when it kind of hit the big time?
That's the thing that interests me. I was living on the East Coast at the time. That's what grabbed me. I was when I first introduced it to me, and I believe they built a tremendous following from that. So they do have great attendance in the small town of Hayward every year in July. But it's not on that anymore. You know, they don't get that same television hit nationwide. I'm sure there's different kinds of television in regional groups that show things, but that helped build the popularity.
Now, you mentioned some past legends, but are there other like, you know, memorable legends? Is there like a Paul Bunyan of the contest or anything?
Paul Bunyan, I think, is the overall symbol of it. But there's a fellow named J.R. Salzman, who was a soldier in Desert Storm, who was a star in the log rolling before he left, and was a casualty of war with his wounds, lost an arm, was in an explosion, and then came back and tried to compete right away. He rushed his comeback, but then a year after that, and this was probably around 2007 or 8, I'm trying to remember the exact year, he won another world title, and he's won 9 world titles. And so he's a guy who really made a comeback after suffering war wounds, fighting for his country. And he's one of the most inspirational athletes I've ever been around.
Lou, did you ever try your hand at any of these events, see how hard it was?
I could tell how. I had too much respect for those events to do them. I don't have that kind of balance. I'm an old guy, and I surely didn't have the kind of body and build that it took to saw quickly. So that would be those football linemen fit in very well with that, and I'm a much smaller guy. I used to be a cross-country runner.
Well, Lou, thanks a lot for joining us today and telling us about it.
Well, it's right down the street from you, so I'm sure that many of your listeners have been there, and I'm sure they enjoy it.
Terrific. Well, we were talking with Lou Friedman, the author of Timber, the story of the Lumberjack World Championships happening, as Lou says, in Hayward, Wisconsin.
I'm not superstitious.
It's down to the wire for the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. With just over a week remaining in the current session, the court has yet to announce some of its biggest decisions. Most notable are the challenge to the Affordable Care Act and the constitutionality of same-sex marriage.
Some decisions were announced today, but we're also waiting for decisions in cases looking at lethal injections, EPA regulations, housing discrimination, and redistricting. The Supreme Court is slated to announce decisions this Thursday, but it's unknown which decisions will come down on which days.
Here with us now to lay out what's at stake and possibly make some predictions is Howard Schwaber. He's a political science and legal studies professor at UW-Madison. He's an expert in constitutional law and legal theory. Welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there were a few things that came out today, right? There was the Spider-Man thing and the Raisin decision, right? Am I missing anything?
You're correct. Both interesting cases, one for its content and one for its style. So in the Spider-Man case, Elena Kagan, the issue had to do with a copyright dispute between a doll manufacturer and Marvel Comics, and there isn't any really great legal substance and import to the underlying legal issues unless you're involved in a very particular area of intellectual property. But Justice Kagan chose to use several lines lifted directly from Spider-Man comics in her opinion. She's an avowed comics fan, and comic nerds all over America rejoice in hearing familiar phrases appear in the mouth of the U.S. Supreme Court.
And one of them was with great power comes great responsibility.
With great power comes great responsibility, a classic line from the Marvel Universe.
That's a quote of Uncle Ben, right,
okay,
from Spider-Man. And then the other one was like the Spider-Man theme that she quoted. So she really went over the top.
Well, she did. And frankly, it wasn't all as subtle as it might have been. But as a reach out to a population that rarely is recognized by Supreme Court justices, certainly it was a nice gesture.
And basically, this person had created a device that shoots out webs, and he had a deal with Marvel. And then when his patent ran out, they stopped paying him, right? Is that the main thing?
And as Kagan put it, patents do provide certain superpowers, but they are not eternal.
Right. Well, that's good. And then the other one was, some people said it was sort of like the little guy winning out a little bit. Could you tell us about that?
Well, the Raisin case is actually substantially more interesting. It goes all the way back to the New Deal. And the famous story of U.S. Supreme Court history is that when the New Deal comes around, for the first couple of years, the Supreme Court resolutely stops Roosevelt and his administration from doing all the things they want to do. And then in 1937, there's this huge shift, and thereafter, the Supreme Court interprets the Commerce Clause to allow the federal government to do practically anything. And it's only in recent years that there have been really any limitations at all as to what the Commerce Clause reaches. The Commerce Clause is the provision that gives the federal government authority to regulate interstate commerce.
And so basically what happened with this guy is he was a raisin farmer, right?
He was a raisin farmer. This particular law allowed the federal government to effectively confiscate a portion of the raisin crop every year in order to keep the prices high by keeping the supply low. and the farmers would then be paid what the government concluded was the proper market value of the raisins they had taken away. The raisins were given to schools and charities and sold overseas. And there's very little question that farmers made out very poorly in the deal. What's interesting about this case is that it reopens the pot. I mean, this is a 65, 66-year-old law. The finding was that when the government takes physical property like raisins away, they have to pay compensation. That by itself is not terribly contentious, except that previously the cases about compensation have involved what's called real property, houses and buildings. So the first interesting point here is that personal property, things that are not buildings, may be subject to compensation under the Takings Clause. And the second interesting point is that even very long-standing laws from way back in the 1930s and the New Deal can be reconsidered, and the Commerce Clause may turn out not to support them after all with the new court that's in place.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Now those two are not very significant ones. They're not the ones that people are really waiting for.
Well, they are if you're a raisin farmer, but no.
Yeah, right. The big ones are coming up later this week, right?
Right. Well, we think. They could even be delayed to the week after. There's no rule that requires the court to announce these things at a certain date, just a tradition.
Okay. I suppose the big ones are Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage. Now, both of these are pretty significant, right?
They're huge, absolutely. Which one should we discuss first?
Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act first.
Right. So the Affordable Care Act King versus Burwell, turns on a single phrase that says federal subsidies are available in states where the states have established insurance exchanges. And now, at this point, anything else that I say is going to be contentious because the two sides read what follows completely differently.
Okay.
One side reads it like this. All federal laws are complicated. Congress writes laws by committee. They then go to other committees. They're resolved by reconciliation between the House and the Senate. They're often hundreds of pages long. It's absolutely inevitable. If you've ever tried to write something by a committee, you know it's absolutely inevitable that there will be inconsistencies. And there's a very, very long-standing set of rules called canons of construction. And these say that where a court finds a piece of a law that doesn't seem to make sense, they should read it in a way that makes the rest of the law make sense. And there are a few other rules. They should read words in their ordinary usage and things like this. So by that argument, this court should do what courts traditionally do when confronted by a piece of a federal law. They should ask, how should we read this to make the entire law make sense in light of the purposes Congress had in mind when it was adopted? And that argument would say, therefore, subsidies should be allowed in all states, regardless of whether they have state exchanges or not, because the purpose of the law, after all, was to extend health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The opposing argument says, well, those general rules are fine for an ordinary case, but this is not an ordinary case. It's a highly political law. It was highly controversial. And there's an argument that Congress or some congressmen actually intended the specific provision to say that subsidies are only available to states that establish subsidies in order to put pressure on states to do so. If certain states then decided, too bad, we're not going to do it anyway, the federal government therefore does not have the authority to turn around and grant them subsidies.
And then there are 30 states, including Wisconsin.
34 states and more than 6 million people.
Right.
So the practical matter and the answer in the latter case, right? So if you take the former reading, the one that says we should apply these standard canons of construction to achieve the beneficial purpose, then you'll say the subsidies are fine and there's no problem. If you take the latter reading and say, well, look, if this isn't what Congress really intended to do, Congress can fix it, which is what Justice Scalia said at oral argument, and members of the audience actually laughed out loud. And the reason they laughed out loud is that, of course, the current Congress is dominated by Republicans who are opposed to Obamacare in the first place. I would be perfectly happy to see it fail.
Right.
So politically, there's that set of consequences. But for people around the country, there are 6.5 million people who could lose the subsidies that make health insurance affordable for them. And it's also estimated by the numbers differ depending on who you ask, but every economic estimate is that repealing the federal subsidies would result in very, very dramatic increases in costs, both public government costs and private costs, to cover the cost of health care.
For millions of people.
For millions of people, for state budgets, for the federal budget, across the board.
So this is a pretty huge one. Are you calling this at this point, or are you just watching to see what happens?
I'm not. I mean, first of all, I should say I don't bet on sports because I would lose. And so I don't bet on Supreme Court cases either because my prediction is no better than anybody else's. This one, I think, is very hard to read. There are a couple of ways to go. as is usually the case these days, Justice Kennedy is a particularly interesting candidate, and he seemed sympathetic at oral argument to a very interesting claim that goes like this. It's possible Congress did, or some congressmen did, intend this provision to put pressure on the states, but that could be an improper purpose. That could violate principles of federalism that say the federal government shouldn't do things that effectively coerce states into cooperating. And if Kennedy chooses to accept that argument, that would be a reason for him to find in favor of allowing the federal subsidies. Other than that, I think there are three safe votes for upholding the law, three safe votes for striking it down, and the rest in the middle, and I think this one's a coin toss.
All right. We're talking to Howard Schwaber. He's a political science and legal studies professor at UW-Madison. We're talking about the Supreme Court. Lots of big things coming up in the next week or so, decisions coming up in the next week or so. That's what we'd like to call them in the Supreme Court. I want to talk a little bit about this, the second big issue that people are watching, which is same-sex marriage.
Sure.
This is pretty huge.
It is enormous, and I think everyone realizes, you know, the various reasons why. There are two questions before the court, one of which renders the other moot. The first question is there a constitutional right to same-sex marriage? For same-sex couples to be allowed to get married. Mm-hmm. The second question is, if there is not such a constitutional right, then if some states recognize same-sex marriages, will other states be required to recognize those marriages as well? But of course, if the answer to the first question is yes, that it's a constitutionally guaranteed right, then the second question is essentially moot. I think in this case the court will answer the first question. I think they'll answer yes, there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, and I think it may even be 6-3. That being said, I think it's quite possible there'll be a split as to the rationale. That is, I think there might be three votes accepting the argument that same-sex marriage is a fundamental personal constitutional right under the Due Process Clause. There might be two votes that say that that's not the case, but that access to marriage for same-sex couples is required under the Equal Protection Clause. They would arrive at the same conclusion, but there would be no clear agreement as to the theory, and that would leave open certain questions in the future.
But basically it would make same-sex marriage legal across the country.
It would, although that does not answer all questions. So go back to that second question for a minute. Supposing some states recognized same-sex marriage and some states did not. Most of the precedents tell us that in that case, one state would not be required to recognize a marriage in another state. For example, different states have different age limits or different limits of consanguinity, relationship, half-brothers, first cousins, second cousins, and so on. That limit when people can get married. And there's a very long-standing tradition that says if it's a matter of public policy, a state is not required to recognize a marriage performed in another state.
Hmm.
So by that logic, if there is not a federally constitutionally guaranteed right to same-sex marriage, there's a perfectly good argument that even if some states choose to recognize same-sex marriage, other states would not be required to accept those marriages. Even if there is a federal constitutionally recognized right of same-sex marriage, there are all sorts of other questions on which states might differ. In terms of divorce, for one thing, mm-hmm. specific legal prerogatives, a whole range of questions, I'm sure things I can't even think of that clever state legislators will come up with as a way to put roadblocks in the way of a policy that they don't like. And all of those questions will have to be worked out, and it will take time. But certainly an affirmative ruling, which I do expect, on that first question will mean no state will be able to say we refuse to marry same-sex couples as a blanket policy anymore.
Well, we're talking to Howard Schwaber. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison about the coming Supreme Court decisions as the court session comes to a close.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the remaining cases, including the challenge to the Affordable Care Act and the constitutionality of same-sex marriage? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the remaining Supreme Court decisions of the current session, including two that look at the Affordable Care Act and the same-sex marriage. We're talking to Howard Schwaber now, political science professor at UW-Madison.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have questions about the Supreme Court and some of the things they're talking about as they wrap things up this year? You can call us at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions about the remaining decisions or how they'll affect Wisconsin? Again, the number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can make your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. In addition to the two cases Veronica mentioned, the court will also release decisions on EPA regulations, redistricting, housing discrimination, and lethal injections. Howard Schwaber, we were talking a little bit about same-sex marriage again. So basically, this could continue to be a complicated issue no matter what happens with the Supreme Court. Is that what you were basically saying?
There will be some complicated issues, absolutely, no matter what happens. Different states may have different rules for things like adoption, property division, common law marriages, divorce, you know, a whole range of issues that may or may not themselves raise constitutional dimensions. But if the court, as I expect, rules in favor of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, then the basic question would be resolved for all 50 states.
Now would a decision like this be considered like one of those big Supreme Court decisions of all time?
This would unquestionably be one of the major landmarks of this generation.
What are some other cases? I mean, the Affordable Care Act and same-sex marriage are definitely getting a lot of attention, but what are some others that are particularly interesting to you that are remaining at this point?
Well, there's a big one about housing discrimination, and it has a very long and cumbersome name, Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus the Inclusive Communities Project. I have no idea what we will eventually call that for short. The question has to do with what's called disparate impact. So it goes like this. Imagine you have a bank making housing loans, and you discover over a period of time that the bank's loans have a very, very distinct racial pattern, which white customers get a certain set of terms, and African-American customers get a very different set of terms. You can't prove that one particular banker one day at a meeting said, I know what let's do. Let's screw the minorities. But you can show there's been this pattern over a long period of time, and you can trace the pattern to some particular piece of documentation or of calculation that the bank uses. Is that enough to bring a claim under the Fair Housing Act? And up until now, the answer has been yes. That's called a disparate impact claim. Mm-hmm. It says, I can't show a specific intent to discriminate, but I can show that your practices end up having a disparate impact and that the impact cannot be justified by other factors. For example, it's not the case that all the white borrowers had better credit ratings or something like that.
I see.
So that's an unbelievably powerful and important tool because, after all, a lot of discrimination and a lot of segregation, particularly in housing and bank loans, occur in ways that are parts of very complex processes, and there often is not, I mean, even if there is a malicious racist intent at work, there may not be a moment where one person said, aha, I have a plan. So for people who believe that this is an ongoing and serious problem, and there's lots and lots of evidence that it is, the disparate impact test is critically important. The Supreme Court is being asked to strike down that test, to say that under the Fair Housing Act, you can't bring a claim or successful claim unless you can point to a particular person who says, I had this particular intent to exclude minorities. And to give you an example of how severe the problem remains, as recently as 2011, Countrywide Mortgage paid a $335 million settlement because the Justice Department found that they had engaged in a widespread and ongoing practice of racial discrimination in terms of making subprime mortgages and mortgage terms and rates and conditions, after controlling for all issues of economics, geography, credit rating, and other factors. Hmm. So this is a continuing issue. Redlining is a continuing issue. I don't think anyone who has studied the question disagrees that banking, mortgages, and the housing industry still feature a great deal of racially disparate treatment. The Supreme Court is being asked to make it much more difficult under current federal law to make a claim for that kind of disparate treatment. And, of course, the question then goes back to Congress again, and the current Congress, we assume, would not be inclined to relax that standard.
Well, that'll be an interesting one to watch. We have lots of people on the line. If you want to join with any questions about the Supreme Court right now, you can call 800-642-1234, but let's go to Philip in Maple first. Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding Article 4, Section 1 of the Constitution, the full faith and credit section. Seems to me that this would automatically apply to the gay marriage situation, that states are supposed to give full faith and credit to all judicial and other, you know, civil actions of the other states. Why isn't this, you know, totally a moot point? Because the Constitution allows this already. And also, you know, I'm not aware that any state has ever disallowed a regular marriage or a divorce that took place in any other state. You know, why is this an issue at all?
Philip, thanks for that question. Howard, you want to answer that?
It's a great question. I have to say, initially, I thought Philip was asking about Article 1, Section 4, which is the Elections Clause. I thought he was going to take us in a whole different direction. Sorry about that. But there's another case that involves that the Supreme Court is currently considering. Right, Article 4, Section 1 is the Full Faith and Credit Clause, and it says that each state must give well, full faith and credit to the acts of another state. Historically, over a period of more than 100 years, that clause has been interpreted somewhat restrictively. And one of the particular and specific areas in which it is held not to require states to recognize actions of other states is marriages. And in fact, there have been lots of cases, historically, of states not recognizing marriages performed in other states, either because of age restrictions or blood restrictions, or back before Loving versus Virginia, because of race considerations. So when some states outlawed interracial marriages, and some states allowed interracial marriages, states that disallowed such marriages were not required to recognize them if they'd been performed elsewhere. So if an interracial couple got married in Massachusetts, Alabama was not required to recognize them as a married couple. And there's actually a long body of case law on this. Philip is absolutely right that if you read the full faith and credit law full faith and credit clause, you know, straightforwardly, you might think it means every state must recognize everything every other state does and is not entitled to dispute it. That's a plausible interpretation, but in the period from the late 1800s until today, our courts have never read it in quite that way. They've always read a large exception, and the exception is basically where doing so would violate the receiving state's public policy. They will not be required to give credence to the other state's actions.
Well, let's go to another call, Mike in Madison. Mike, welcome to Central Time. What's your comment or question?
Good afternoon. My question is regarding the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. Basically, if this Affordable Care Act is struck down, how would that play into the mandatory auto insurance that they have? If the Supreme Court does not recognize health care, being forced to purchase health care, if they recognize it as unconstitutional, then how does that play into the mandatory auto insurance? And with the insurance companies, because a lot of them do health insurance as well as auto and stuff, I would imagine there would be somebody lobbying to keep the Affordable Care so that it doesn't roll over and affect auto insurance.
Mike, thanks for that question. Howard, do you want to take that one?
Well, there's several moving parts to Mike's question. First of all, the question of mandatory insurance is not being considered by the court right now. The Supreme Court's already ruled on that and already upheld it. If the Supreme Court had ruled differently and struck down the mandatory insurance provision of the Affordable Care Act, that would not have affected mandatory auto insurance, because mandatory auto insurance is at the state level. And the challenge that was brought was to Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, coincidentally what we were talking about in the Raisin case, to ask whether the federal government can require insurance. There's no question that a state can require you to have any kind of insurance that it wants. The only question is whether the federal government has the same authority. But as I say, that's not the question that the Supreme Court is considering this time around. This time they're not thinking about striking down the law, only ruling that the federal government is not permitted to provide subsidies in the 34 states which there are not state insurance exchanges. And so the consequence would be that for the people who live in those states who are poor, they would lose subsidies that currently enable them to buy health insurance. Many of them would lose their insurance, others would have to buy more expensive insurance, and there would be a ripple effect on both governmental and private spending. Again, the numbers are disputed, but all the analysts agree that the consequence would be a significant increase in costs.
Well, there's so much to discuss here, and we only scratched the surface right now. Howard, I believe we'll probably have you on again pretty soon here.
It would be my pleasure.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. We've been talking to Howard Schwaber. He's a political science and legal studies professor at UW-Madison. Talked about some of the coming decisions from the Supreme Court. The court will next announce decisions on Thursday, and we'll wrap up its session in a little over a week. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.